let's come back to order and take up our next topic on the agenda today. If I can find my agenda in this pile of paper.
Yep.
We are back on the record at the Tuesday, August 26th, 2014, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency board meeting. We are taking up the High Water Ethanol LLC Major Amendment Air Permit. And leading off this presentation will be Jeff Smith. And Jeff, go ahead and introduce other presenters.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division here at the agency. To my right is Sarah Kilgriff. She's a supervisor in the Air Quality Compliance and Enforcement Unit. And to my left is Ann Cohen, member of the Attorney General's Office. So today we're going to take up the High Water contested case hearing request and the offer to finally issue the permit. Again, here are the presenters. And on there is also the supporting staff through the Industrial Division and the Outcomes Division that worked on this particular permit. So a couple of things I'd like to do today is walk through the biofuel industry. We know we've got some newer board members, so just to give a little context for the biofuel industry and this particular project, we'll talk through the contested case hearing request, and then we'll have a staff recommendation. So quickly, a biofuel. The simple explanation, I think most of us are familiar with biofuels here in Minnesota. It's a conversion of a formerly living plant material into a fuel process through carbon fixation. The material is often called biomass, and usually it's plants and algae. In Minnesota, corn is very popular because we have an abundance of corn. It's readily available, and so therefore, corn it seems to be the primary biomass that we use here for the creation of biofuel. In particular, it's ethanol. Biofuels and biomass conversion can result in fuel in a solid, liquid, or gas form. And as we all understand, biofuels have increased in popularity because of rising oil prices and the need for energy security and the benefits to Minnesotans. In Minnesota, as I said, ethanol is the thing that's mostly built or mostly created. Also, there is biodiesel and biobutanol. The process itself is simply fermenting ground corn and water with yeast and distilling that fermented liquid to extract pure ethanol. There are a few plants in Minnesota that create biobutanol as well. In Minnesota, the biofuels industry began about 1990. Currently, we've got about 21 permits, about 25 facilities. Some are not operating. I would say we've learned a lot through the evolution of the biofuel industry. We've had lots of ups and downs. We've learned along with the industry in terms of technology and compliance. We've done quite a bit of enforcement over the years, and that's been across the board. It's certainly not unique to the High Water facility. The responsibility for Minnesota, our job as the Pollution Control Agency, is to administer the federal Clean Air, Clean Water, and Resource Conservation Recovery Act requirements. That means that we issue permits, air and water permits, sometimes haz waste and sometimes tanks permits. These permits, as you've heard in the past, spell out the requirements for reporting. They also have emission and discharge limits to make sure that what's coming out of these facilities comply with the appropriate state and federal regulations, so they're protective of human health and the environment. We also do compliance and enforcement inspections and respond to complaints as they come up around these particular facilities. So the technology itself, I will say, is always changing. I think in terms of the future, we often see ebbs and flows of the industry, but in general, this type of industry, the refining industry, will be around for many years to come and will be changing. We see the technology for the treatment of wastewater and for cleaning up air, meeting air emission limits, to be changing all the time. And so it's important for us as state employees and members of the Pollution Control Agency to be connected with the industry and be changing with them. So we're part of, for instance, we're part of the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. So we're often hearing about changes to the ethanol industry that'll take place in future projects. So again, we take seriously our job in protecting human health and the environment and issuing timely and appropriate permits. So a little bit about the facility itself. This is the High Water facility located in southwestern Minnesota, Lamberton, Minnesota, about a mile west of Lamberton, again, west of Mankato, right in the Corn Belt agricultural area of Minnesota. The proximity to water, as you heard during the previous board item, as well as corn and rail lines, good lines for movement of the materials, is critical, and that's why most of the 21 facilities we have are located in southwestern Minnesota. Here's a little snapshot of the facility itself. One of the questions that I get oftentimes is whether this is more like a farming industry or a business, manufacturing. It is more like a refinery in that sense, and this gives you a sense about the sort of layout of a typical facility. This is the High Water facility. But it is an organized facility. They're an industry, again, much like a refinery. Sometimes they're cooperatively held, that is, owned by farmers, and sometimes they're privately held as national, international businesses. A little bit about the permit history. In 2007, we authorized to construct and operate this particular plant. In 2012, along with our five-year permit cycle, we reissued the permit, made a couple of small changes, including allowing them to expand the creation of ethanol, the making of ethanol by about 5 million gallons. It's a 58 million gallon per year facility. That's how much ethanol they create every year. The project before you today was a project proposed back in January 2014. It's a major permit amendment, which means it requires a public notice and a level of scrutiny on our part such that it's a big enough project to require more action from us versus an administrative-type permit action, which is a simpler action. We worked with the company and put the draft permit out in public notice in April 2014. It was a 30-day public notice, and during that public notice in April, we received a contested case hearing request from the petitioners. These were neighbors to the facilities, two families. I think I'll also mention that during that public notice, we received no other petitions for contested case hearing requests. In fact, we didn't receive any other comments during that public notice period. So with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Cohen to explain a little bit about the contested case hearing process.
Thank you. Welcome to the board, Ms. Cohen.
Thank you. I'm Ann Cohen from the Attorney General's Office, and Mr. Smith has asked me to briefly describe the contested case hearing process to you and maybe highlight a few questions that will come up in the material that follows. So anyway, I think some of you have attended a training session that the Attorney General's Office provided for board members on various aspects of administrative law, including the contested case hearing process. Essentially, the contested case hearing process is intended to help this agency resolve issues of fact. So this agency, from time to time, will refer matters over to the Office of Administrative Hearings for development primarily of a factual record. So at the Office of Administrative Hearings, the various witnesses will be brought forward by the staff and by persons who believe that they have a factual dispute with the staff. The evidence will go before an administrative law judge who is independent of this agency. That judge will make recommended findings of fact and recommendations, and those recommendations and findings will be brought back in front of the commissioner or this board as appropriate for a final decision, which does not have to be consistent with those recommended findings of fact. In fact, it's not uncommon that agencies will tweak the findings of the administrative law judge and change the recommendations. But essentially, that is the process. It's very much like a hearing. So this agency has a rule that helps this agency decide which cases are appropriate for contested case hearing. And in your board memorandum from the staff, on page 5, you'll see the criteria that this board uses to decide which cases are appropriate for referral over to the Office of Administrative Hearings for a contested case hearing. Essentially, there must be a material issue of fact. We don't refer cases over to the Office of Administrative Hearing to decide minor issues that are not really important to the decision before the agency. They have to be material issues, and they do have to be disputed. The board here must have the jurisdiction over that issue. So, for example, we wouldn't refer an issue to the Office of Administrative Hearings that has to do with the jurisdiction of a local governmental unit. So only issues that this board actually has to decide are appropriate. And then finally, there must be a reasonable basis underlying the disputed material issue of fact. There has to be some showing on the part of the person requesting the contested case hearing that their position has some basis in fact, such that it would be possible to move through an organized hearing process where both sides would produce the information that they had for the administrative law judge so that that judge could make a recommendation. So when should the board grant a contested case hearing? When it has jurisdiction over a material issue of fact and there is a reasonable dispute over that. So the third bullet you see here is, can a contested case hearing issue be resolved? And this issue is one that I am highlighting today because, as you will hear in the presentation that follows, here the staff felt that the issue that was raised in the petition was a valid issue. And staff also agreed that it was a material issue, that if true, it really would put into question whether this agency should amend the permit to allow this company to add the equipment that they were seeking to add. So as the staff will present, there was an investigation done of this issue. Staff concluded that the petitioners were correct and changes needed to be made. And today, the issue that will be before the board is, having made those changes to the permit, whether the material issue has been resolved. Because if it has been resolved, then there would be no point in asking for the administrative law judge to make a finding on that issue. If you agree that the issue has been resolved, then there is no longer a material issue of fact that is pending before this agency. Are there any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. I do have a question. So your last statement is I just want to be sure I heard it correctly, that the question of is there a material issue of fact is substantive before us today. So we're going to be listening for whether or not the petitioners are bringing forward something that hasn't yet been fully addressed. Am I correct in sort of just restating that?
Commissioner, members of the board, I think that's essentially true. This is a rather unusual circumstance in my experience here, that, you know, staff, when they got the petition, they did an investigation. They found the issue to be valid, and there has been an attempt to resolve that issue. And so the question is, given that attempt, the conditions put in the permit, the changes that are being made, does this board find that there yet remains a material issue of fact?
Thank you. Mr. Smith?
Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, so now I'd like to turn it over. We're going to go through a little bit of the history that occurred during the spring and summer since the contested case hearing request was submitted. We're going to talk about our compliance and enforcement activities, our inspection activities, and the specific changes we made to the permit that get us to the point where, again, the MPCA staff believe and our recommendation will reflect that we have put forth a draft permit, a new draft permit that is much beefier than the one that we had public noticed in April. It's not to say that the one we public noticed in April was insufficient. It had all of the requirements that are part of the state and federal conditions. It had requirements that they comply with the noise standard, but it was after the contested case hearing request was submitted and our conversations with the citizens to specifically understand their concerns that we discovered and thought that we could do more, and that resulted in the changes you'll see in the draft permit today. So with that, I'd like to turn over to Ms. Kilgriff to explain our compliance enforcement activities.
Thank you, Ms. Kilgriff. Welcome to the board.
Good afternoon, Commissioner Stein and members of the board. As Jeff said, my name is Sarah Kilgriff. I'm the supervisor of the Air Quality Compliance and Enforcement Unit here at the agency, and I'll be covering some of the historical and current compliance and enforcement activities with regard to high water ethanol. Historically, on April 14, 2011, the agency entered into a stipulation agreement for air and water quality violations with high water ethanol. On September 26, 2011, the agency entered into a schedule of compliance for noise violations. At that time, noise mitigation was put into place and a follow-up noise survey did show compliance. However, it should be noted that there is a history of noise complaints with the facility from 2010 to the present. I'm going to take a minute just to brief you on the noise standards in the state of Minnesota. That's a continuous measurement of noise levels that are measured over, or averaged rather, over an hour and then compared to daytime or nighttime limits. And limits must be exceeded for 6 minutes of the hour or more to be considered a violation. We have both an L10 limit and an L50 limit. The L10 limit is that limit or noise level that is exceeded for 10% of the hour or 6 minutes. And the L50 limit is the noise level that is exceeded for 50% of the time or 30 minutes of the hour. As a frame of reference for you, a change in decibel levels and perceived change in loudness can be characterized as plus or minus 1 decibel would be not a noticeable change. Plus or minus 3 decibels would be about the threshold of perception. Plus or minus 5 decibels would be a noticeable change. Plus or minus 10 decibels would be twice or half as loud. And plus or minus 20 decibels would be 4 times or 1/4 as loud. For further comparison, the decibel levels of various sounds can be akin to a quiet rural area would be around 40 decibels. A normal conversation between you and myself would be around 60 decibels. A passing car at 10 feet would be around 80 decibels. And threshold of pain would be around 120 decibels. I want to note that you may hear testimony today about other noise readings that have been taken by others at the facility. However, I just want to note that the equipment used to take those readings does not have the capability to average noise over that hour averaging period that I discussed. And it should be noted that those instantaneous noise readings may or may not indicate violations. The hourly averages are the only way to compare with the Minnesota noise limits. However, the agency has monitored noise on 2 occasions at the facility, and we have confirmed that noise violations have occurred, and we have required or are currently requiring corrective measures to be taken. In terms of our current compliance and enforcement, on April 30th, 2014, the MPCA conducted an inspection. It was discovered during that inspection that the company had installed a new hammer mill prior to receiving a permit to do so, and that they had self-reported some visible emissions readings that they had missed. It should be noted, however, that the hammer mill had not and was not being operated at the time and was not connected to a power source, so it did not contribute to noise readings that we took subsequently on June 3rd, 2014. A noise survey was conducted on June 3, 2014, as I mentioned, and that was at 4:30 a.m., so it was compared to the nighttime noise standards, and we did document 2 violations of the nighttime noise standard. We did inform the company after that of those violations, and they have been very responsive in beginning to work on corrective measures for those violations. I will point out briefly that noise monitoring was conducted as per the map that you see here at the nearest location to the facility from which we had logged complaints. which is approximately a quarter mile away from the facility. And we did take those noise readings at the closest residential area nearest to the facility because we wanted to ensure that we would be recording the highest noise readings. So in terms of the results of that noise study, they did show, again, like I said, two violations, both in the L10 and the L50 were violated. The measured L10 value was 58.5 decibels measured against the limit of 55, and the L50 result was 55 decibels measured against the limit of 50. And as you'll recall, the sound level of that normal conversation, again, is around 60 decibels. The threshold of perception is around 3 decibels, and the noticeable change is around 5 decibels. On both June 18th and July 28th, again, after being notified of the violations, the company submitted noise mitigation plans to address those violations. So in terms of our response to those violations and the contested case hearing, the MPCA has completed both an enforcement action and permitting measures. In terms of enforcement, on July 21st, 2014, we did issue an administrative penalty order to the company, and we required the company to complete corrective actions. One of those corrective actions was to cease construction of activities that would have required a permit, so to cease construction on the hammer mill. They also had to submit documentation showing which noise mitigation measures they had completed already and which were to follow, and a schedule moving forward. They were also required to submit a noise monitoring plan for our review and approval that was to contain follow-up noise survey that must be completed 30 days after completion of their corrective measures or no later than October 30th of 2014. The plan also contained a requirement to monitor noise on an annual basis going forward and to complete daily inspections done during each shift to ensure that noise mitigation equipment and materials were in place and functioning properly. As a result of those corrective measures, on August 7, 2014, the MPCA closed the administrative penalty order when those corrective actions were completed and when the penalty was paid. Those noise mitigation measures required by the administrative penalty order will be incorporated into the facility permit, which Mr. Smith can explain further.
Thank you. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the board. So, as Sarah explained, we began action as soon as the contested case hearing request was submitted, and we used sort of our typical response, which is compliance and enforcement, inspections, along with what needs to be done to modify the permit. The compliance enforcement activities, in this case, the APO, will take care of the short-term corrective actions by the company and will appropriately penalize them for the noncompliance. The longer-term issues, typically we roll into the permit where we can better track it and manage it and write some specific language that carries on past the closing of the APO in this case. The first call we made after receiving the contested case hearing request was to the petitioners. As Ms. Cohen said, receiving a noise complaint, a contested case hearing request around noise, is somewhat unique for us. So we wanted to further understand exactly what their specific concerns were and what they wanted to see happen at the facility in terms of corrective actions. So there began a dozen or 15 conversations with the petitioners, and that many, and maybe even more, with the facility itself. Our role in this case was to understand what the petitioners were concerned about, to get their perspective on what corrective actions they would like to see happen in the permit, and to convey that information along with what we would like to see happen to the facility, and have them adopt those changes into the permit requirements and make the changes at the facility. So those conversations occurred over the summer months, just this last summer. And we worked very hard, again, with the citizens and the company to come up with what we think is a nice list of corrective actions in the permit. And I'll say at this point that the permit before you today is the most rigorous and restrictive permit that we've ever issued when it comes to noise controls in the state of Minnesota. It is the gold standard, so to speak, for noise mitigation and tracking and monitoring. So here are the specific things that have changed since the permit was public noticed in April and the one that you've got before you today. These are the corrective actions and the things we did to beef up that particular permit. The company is in the process of relocating ventilation fans and louvers. These are the places where we have, we believe, and the company believes, that most of the noise from the facility are coming from. It's a jet engine sort of sound. It's air moving quickly through these vents causing substantial noise. So their plan is to move those to different parts of the building. There's also the construction of external noise barriers. There's sound dampening partitions in the hammer mill. And the proposed project, by the way, is the addition of two new hammer mills in addition to the two that they have currently. So sound dampening partitions at the hammer mills. We are creating a vegetative barrier. Now, this won't have a lot of impact on overall noise, but based on the location of one of the petitioners, the proximity, this will be a kind of a visual barrier that was suggested by the petitioners. May not have a lot of impact in terms of overall noise, but again, that was a request made by the petitioners. We're going to require annual noise testing throughout this five-year permit cycle. The company submitted a noise monitoring and inspection plan that requires twice-a-day inspections by the facility at both shifts. These must be documented and available to PCA staff when we request them, and it's an enforceable part of the permit. In other words, we can take action if they do not have documentation that they've complied and done the noise mitigation inspections twice a day. Another piece that I'll add in here that was of particular interest to the petitioners was the idea of doors being open. That was believed by the petitioners to be a critical piece of what's contributing to the overall noise at the facility. There's probably some disagreement on, there's a number of buildings, as you recall, from the layout of the facility. Some of the buildings, the main energy center, has the machinery that can contribute to noise. Some of it's administrative, and if the doors are open, will not have a significant impact on overall noise. But at the energy center, where there is the possibility that machinery running could cause and contribute to the noise portion, we are requiring that at night those doors are closed. Again, that's an inspectable requirement, and we think that'll have, especially at night when the noise standard is lower, will have benefits to the citizens and the community. So the last thing is just, I think the board understands this, it requires immediate actions to correct any discrepancies or violations if there are noise problems. So the permit must be complied with. They must take action if excessive noise is discovered. And we believe we've got in place a permit that allows them to operate and reasonably meet the noise standards set in Minnesota. So our staff resolution, I'll say it one more time, is that we deny the contested case hearing request and we finally issue the permit, not because we disagree with the petitioners. They were appropriately, they submitted the contested case hearing request appropriately. It was valid. We took that seriously, and we worked very closely with them and the company to come up with a plan to do enforcement action and put before you a permit that we think has a reasonable chance that they can comply with the noise standard. I'll also say right here that the permit itself is, again, it's important for us to issue the permit right now. If we do not issue the permit right now, we'll default back to the 2012 permit, which does not have any of the things that we're talking about here. It is just the sort of the bare bones issue around operation. It does not allow for the annual noise monitoring. It does not allow for the changes that we discussed here. So it's in our interest as citizens and PCA staff and recommendation to the board that we issue the permit. It allows us to take action if there are continued violations and allows us to do it in a much more efficient way than the previous permit. That's the reason why we're encouraging that the board to recommend the issue of the final permit. So with that, I think I'll pause, and we are available for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, Ms. Cohen, and Ms. Kilgriff. Are there questions for Dr. Foley?
So the contested case hearing process is to use that process to gain information to help us make a decision going forward. Is there any issues that, in your opinion, haven't been thoroughly researched and looked at and answered in your proposal today that a contested case hearing would help us to give us additional information to make that judgment?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Foley, no, we believe we've examined all of the issues surrounding us and taking the most prudent action, and that the current permit reflects that.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Drager.
Commissioner, so have the petitioners then agreed and can they voluntarily withdraw the contested case? And has that been a discussion?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Drager, that was our hope. Part of our goal here was not to come to the board today. We were hoping to sufficiently address all of the citizens' concerns. We had, again, many conversations with them. And again, many of the corrective actions you see here are reflective of what the citizens would have liked us to do. Unfortunately, we could not. Their option was to withdraw their contested case hearing request, and I did ask them to do that throughout the process, and they chose not to, and so that's why we're here today.
And I can mention for the board that there's a representative of the petitioners who will be speaking, who's asked to be heard, so we'll be taking their testimony after we finish with the staff questions. And presumably I see a representative of the company here, and we'll ask the company to speak to the questions before the board as well. So other questions, board members, that you have for Mr. Smith or our team? Very good. Let's move on. Mr. Ullman, I don't know if I've pronounced that correctly, Steve Ullman, is asked to be heard on the question before the board and on behalf of the petitioners. Welcome to the board, and please introduce yourself. And
thank you.
We have just board members, by the way, you've received a packet that Mr. Ullman brought. And if I might ask someone to accept this, make a motion to accept this into the record for the decision before us today, if I could please ask someone to just do that at this time. Mr. Ibarra?
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
Seconded. The motion by Mr. Ibarra and the second by Dr. Foley. Any discussion on the motion? When you have the packet, it includes a letter, a memorandum, and several other documents that are attached. So seeing no further discussion, all those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. We accept the material. So, Mr. Ullman, thank you for coming before us today, and welcome.
Thank you. My name is Steve Ullman. I live rural Lamberton, Minnesota, 1.8 miles directly northwest of High Water Ethanol Facility. Excuse me if I need a proper protocol.
Just go ahead and speak like you're talking to me, Mr. Ullman. That'll be fine.
I'm not very good at this, please bear with me. We purchased the property, the 10-acre building site, approximately 9 years ago. There was a little discussion 2-3 years later. High Water Ethanol is going to build. No, they're not going to build. We were never notified. Never. We don't subscribe to local papers. And found out they were going to build a plant. In August of what year? 2009, after the plant was built, I came riding home. I was a commander of a Legion post, and I was riding my motorcycle home, and I got in front of Bill Martinson's house, and I never knew Bill Martinson until 3 or 4 years ago, the other petitioner. I thought a jet aircraft was going to crash on me on the highway, and I had my helmet on. I pulled over, and I went, "Lord, what's going on?" Well, it's the ethanol. It's 4:30 in the morning. Hot, humid August evening. I went home. I was extremely upset. It was just roaring at my house. It's sounding like you're standing next to a 2,000-horsepower boiler. I called the Redwood County administrator and asked to be put on the commissioner's agenda. 35 minutes later, Redwood County commissioner shows up at my doorstep. John Schuler, who happened to be, I didn't know anybody in this situation, no one. Well, he says, I'm going to be the vice president out here at High Water Ethanol. I said, really? He says, you called about the noise. And I said, good Lord, what's going on here with this noise? And Mr. Schuler stood in front of my house, and he looked over at the ethanol, and he says, my, that certainly is loud, and I'm hard of hearing. I think we're going to have a problem here. And I said, well, who are you representing here today? And I said, you guys got to close your doors. You got to do something. What's going on with this noise? He says, well, he says, he laughs, and he says, we're not going to close our doors. He says, you close your windows and turn on your air conditioner. And left. We attended many, many, many Redwood County Commissioner meetings with Planning and Zoning Commission. The noise was unbearable. It sounds a roar, a rumble, a shake, and there's a whine thrown in there here and there. We have 6-inch walls in our ranch home, Anderson windows, and we have to have fans running at night in order to sleep. I was introduced to Bill Martinson. Never met the gentleman in my life. And we talked, and he says, come on over to my house. I said, how can you stand to live here? Well, we went to many meetings, and absolutely nothing happened with Redwood County. We're out on a limb. We found out 3 of the Redwood County commissioners actually built this facility. And there was far too much conflict of interest for any of us to get any resolve. So we called the sheriff many, many, many times. Finally, we called the MPCA. It's no secret. I'm the one that took the pictures of high water ethanol putting their water on agricultural land. I'm the one that turned them in. They got their $150,000 fine. And I got to know a couple of folks at the MPCA via the telephone. Anything goes on, we'd appreciate it. You take a picture. We need eyes out in the field. So when the noise started, we started calling Sheriff Randy Hansen. Probably 200 complaints with the county. Finally, the MPCA arranged one of their individual's staff to come out and do a sound study, accompanied by Sheriff Randy Hansen, and they were in violation of the first sound study. We, after that point, Mr. Martinson and myself, purchased sound equipment. It's NIST government certified and calibrated. And recently, in June of 2014, I stood side by side with the MPCA's equipment, and they have very nice equipment. However, my decibel meter read consistently within 1/10 of a decibel of what was being recorded by the MPCA. From the period of 2011, until 2014, I only made one copy and attached of bills to the Minnesota duty officer. He has, what, 397? I left mine at home. I quit counting. What difference does it make if there's one or 500? They're all the same. We know the Minnesota duty officer by name. We chose out of respect not to consume the time of the Redwood County Sheriff's Department and bother these folks anymore. There's nothing they could do. But it took 3 years of begging and pleading and phone calls to the MPCA to come out and conduct another sound study. And the only reason, the sound study was only granted after we filed the petition. I don't think they came out to validate our claims. I think they came out to disprove it. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But it does not appear that it was met with good intentions. We're pretty simple people. Bill and I are both Vietnam veterans. We're retired. We want to enjoy life. And this noise is absolutely deafening. Cindy has an ear implant. She's due for a new one. It's plenty old. But the certain tones of the pitch of the vibration of that air and that percussion cause her a great deal of headaches. And Cindy chose not to speak today, and I understand that. I respect that. The situation with high water ethanol asked me one day in the county, and what do you want, Steve? Come on, Steve, what do you want? My goodness, we want it quiet, comply with the law. That's all we want. We don't want anything from you people. Just comply with the law, for goodness sakes. I would like to sleep at night. And I'm sure Bill and Mary. I was over to Bill's 3 days ago, 64.5 decibels at 5 o'clock in the morning. Working with Mr. Smith, I respect Mr. Smith. I think he's a true professional, and you should be happy to have that fella working here. But I do not agree with him. It felt as though he was trying to convince us to withdraw our request for a contested case hearing. And it got to the point where I can do more for you than the board can. I can do more for you. What do you guys want? Come on. I can do a lot more for you. You're not going to be happy what you get out of the board. And then finally, I got a deadline coming up here. I was surprised to learn this morning of his deadline, that it reverted back to a 2012 or whatever permit. We didn't know that. But he was truly, honestly trying with his best intentions to get us to understand what was going on for the changes. We almost felt intimidated and threatened at the end, not by his tone of voice, not by his specific dialogue, but just in the way it was addressed to us. Please, you must understand, we have been beaten down by government agencies for 5 years. But we will never quit, because we are innocent victims, the recipients of a facility that is in violation of Minnesota statutes and noise. And we think we should at least be afforded some protection under those statutes, rules, and regulations. Mr. Martinson, I think a lot of Bill. He's a very honorable man. He couldn't come, and there's a letter attached here. He's got some health concerns. Bill's not one to go on and on and on. He's a big man. He's 6'5", probably 260, pretty good shape. When he talks, you listen. And when he said, he came over yesterday morning and, Steve, I can't do it. saw the man shake. But I respect his decision for not coming. We respectfully, truly respectfully request that this be forwarded for a contested case hearing. We want nothing more than for this situation to be under oath. There is so much that is not even included in what I have said. When I came in here, I will be very honest with you, ladies and gentlemen, the impression I had was the board will do what we recommend, period. I thought, wow, that's unbelievable. After sitting here for quite some time today, listening to you, you're a pretty intelligent group of people. You've got compassion, you've got understanding, you've got education, you ask a lot of the right questions. High Water Ethanol has had 3+ years to correct this noise problem. Nothing's been done. What is the urgency? Other than the fact I learned that today is something about it reverts to a 2012 permit. What's the urgency? They've had 3 years to correct this problem. Well, we promise we're going to do this. We promise we're going to do that. No. Because of their poor management and poor business practices, that does not constitute an emergency on your folks' part. I hadn't planned on saying any of this. I can't. I'm not good at writing stuff down. I'm the guy responsible. You can blame for idiosyncrasies in this. But after what I saw the board do today, I've got a great deal of respect for you people. I'm impressed. I'm a former state employee. I was a master electrician at a college. Some of the state employees are not so good, and some are excellent. But I appreciate the fact that you let me talk here today. We do not believe that High Water Ethanol's promise, we'll do this by this date, we don't put any stock in their word, not their written word. When the MPCA put in the request for their new permit, they put in there for High Water Ethanol to be responsible for their own sound studies. To me, that is absolutely ludicrous. They tried that 3 years ago, and look where it's gotten us all. That's why we're here today. We begged the state to come back out and verify those sound studies, that they were not proper. The state refused to do it. As a master electrician, everything we had in the state college was state of the art. Myself, the engineers, the mechanical people, HVAC people, were all competent and qualified to go up to any variable frequency drive, digital computer-controlled equipment that controls that motor. We could change the inputs, the parameters, the set points, the data, and any one of you folks, anybody, I'll say, yes, sirree, she's running at 100%. Not by a long shot. I have everything manipulated. You will see it says 100%, but in fact, it could be operating at 18 to 20%. So the people, even though they may have good intentions to come out and do their sound studies, they have no way of knowing if it's actually 100%. That's a manipulation of equipment. They have good intentions. They have reputations on the line. Yes, sir. I did that sound study, and I saw it with my own eyes. It was running at 100%. No, it wasn't. Come out to our house. Take a sound study. We'll tell you when it's running at 100%. We believe the MPCA staff has all good intentions. We do believe they're looking out for our interests as citizens. However, we cannot go home and go to bed tonight with that for security. We know what's happened. I have attached a few things, and I would just like to mention those, if I may. One, I previously mentioned a letter from Bill Martinson. The other, we believe MPCA staff, when they notified us that they were going to recommend to the board, the citizens board, the approval of the new permit. We also believe they informed Highwater Ethanol of that. Prior to that, Highwater Ethanol sent an agreement with a realtor over to Bill Martinson's to buy him out. By the way, we'll buy you out, or we'll put windows and siding on your house if you go to the other petitioner's house and convince him to withdraw. Well, Rome tried divide and conquer. That does not work with two ex-veterans. It does not work. I believe the reason that we believe, or I guess I'll have to say that, no one else is speaking, the reason that that was done, because they know, because of their dry grind operation, that they cannot comply with the Minnesota statutes. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has never had one single complaint of noise on any other ethanol in the state of Minnesota. I have stopped personally by the one in Winthrop 21 times. Have to be on my way to pick up my grandchildren, but I stopped. When I stopped 2 weeks ago, I stopped and talked to the fellow that owns a Napa garage here, restoring a Model A. I said, "Say, may I have a few minutes of your time here?" I said, "I got a couple questions for you. We're looking right at ethanol, a couple thousand feet down the road." He said, "Yeah." He said, "What can I help you with?" I said, "Your ethanol." I said, "Why?" I said, "How loud does that get?" He looked at me like I was from another planet. He said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "How come I never hear this thing?" I said, "How noisy does it get?" He said, "It stinks." But he says, we never hear it. He says, "Where are you from?" I said, "Down by Lamberton." "Oh, we've heard that one's got some noise problems." I talked to someone up north on theirs. No noise complaints. What is different and unique about a supposed state-of-the-art facility in Lamberton that sets it far apart from any other ethanol in the state of Minnesota? MPCA reverts back to, well, we believe, we're speculating now, we think this is going to help quiet that facility down. They have absolutely no data, a criteria, or records to support that claim. Neither does Highwater Ethanol, nor do their engineers, because no one has ever had to quiet down an ethanol in the state of Minnesota. I have just a couple more items, if I may, sir.
Please.
The original conditional use permit that Highwater Ethanol applied with Redwood County. It's in one of the attachments, I believe. They refer to noise on the last page. The bottom of the paragraph under noise, it says, long-term noise impacts associated with traffic and facility operations after construction should be, here's that word again, negligible given the existing nature and volume of traffic. Well, the volume of traffic report that they reported to Redwood County on Highway 14, we're not talking 494 here, was 900 vehicles more a day than it actually is. What difference that makes, I don't even know why they put that in there. It's trivial. So there has been distortions of the truth from the very beginning with this facility. They have done nothing or shown anything since the inception of the operation that we can see has resulted in any less noise. I may also like to add that through these hundreds of phone calls, I was almost on a first-name basis with a couple of staff people at MPCA. I still have never met them. Something's going on. Take some pictures. Could you take some pictures? We can't get out there. We'd appreciate it. Can you email them up there? Yes, I can do that. Well, something's going on out there. There's a lot of work going on out there. Can you take some pictures and send them in? I said, sure, I can do that. Well, I went out there. Stupid me. I sat on a county road taking pictures. Brian Clutcher, the CEO of High Water Ethanol, and Thomas Streifel, the risk and commodity manager, came out to me as I'm taking pictures in their pickups. Mr. Clutcher stayed in his vehicle. Thomas Streifel got out. The long of the short, I know who you are. I know where you live. You're taking pictures. That's illegal. If you cause me to lose my job or you shut this plant down, you will pay. I will get you. What? I turned around, went to Highway 14. Streifel was ahead of me. He comes jumping out of his pickup. He comes back to me and says, well, I'll tell you what I said. I'm a tough guy. I said, hey, cowboy, I'm not afraid of you. Huh, silly. He puts his head in my face, sticking in my window, and says, you heard what I said. If I lose my job because of you, you shut us down, I will get you. You will pay. I immediately called Redwood County Sheriff, went to the courthouse the next morning, got a temporary restraining order. A month later, they contested it. They brought an attorney. I represented myself, had Bill Martinson and Cindy. And the judge granted me a restraining order for 2 years that I not be harassed. The reason I'm implementing that in my findings of facts is for this board to understand the severity and the seriousness and the lengths to which some people are capable. My goodness, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I was standing on a road taking a picture. I'm not the one in violation or proposed or supposed violations. We don't want any more incidents. We would like the board to act responsibly. We pray the board forward this on to a contested case hearing so that it can be under oath. There is so much more to this. And Bill and I, Cindy and Mary, I hate the word victim, but I don't know what else to say. Receivers? I don't know what we are, but we're not the violators.
Thank you, Mr. Ullman. Thank you. Appreciate your time and presenting your information today. I thank you for that. Mr. Riddle, you have a question?
Yeah, thanks for your comments. I just have one question that you posed yourself, but then I didn't hear the answer. And it is, what is different about this facility versus the 20 others that don't have noise problems? So what, in your opinion, is different and what could be done about it?
Mr. Olman.
And briefly, if you can.
Sir, in my opinion, I was a construction electrician for the state for many years. I worked around a lot of equipment. I can't nail that down and say exactly. I could be wrong, but I believe it is a dry grind operation. Many, many people have told me that. People know nothing about the facility. They said they got to be grinding that corn dry, crushing it dry. Versus wet, there's really not much noise associated with that. We have asked for 5 years, what is the source of this noise? I've never found out. No one has ever offered a solution. In their proposed changes, we're going to relocate the fan intakes away from the north side of the road. Well, that leaves one direction to relocate those fans towards my house. They can't point them towards Bill's or City of Lamberton. They can't go south. Well, I guess the only way they can go is north. Well, that's a solution. Instead of Bill having the violations at his house, now they'll be at Steve's. We had asked for the doors to be closed, and it sounds like now they may close them at nighttime. I don't know. There is equipment. I will say this. I would like to add this. I was the very first electrician ever hired by any corn plant in the state of Minnesota at Minnesota Corn Processors in Marshall. That was a monster of a plant. We never had any of the noises, like those noises being emitted out of high water ethanol. Something is very, very wrong with this facility. Very wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Olman. Let's ask the company to come forward and make a presentation about your facility and also just about and respond to questions from board members. Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself to the board.
Sure. Good afternoon. I'm Brian Kutcher, CEO at High Water Ethanol in Lamberton, Minnesota.
Thank you. Just in terms of the your circumstances, Mr. Kutcher, can you just comment on how the proposed, what we have before us today is a recommendation for petition before us, but also just in terms of the company's decisions on what to implement in the way of noise mitigation and reduction at the facility, if you would comment on that, please.
Absolutely. In regards to the fans on the north side of our energy center, first of all, we bring out experts in the field of monitoring a noise so we can find better where the noise is coming from and the frequency of the noise. So we need to address those items. And we hired one company to come out and do it, and we've also consulted with additional companies to provide us with sound barriers to address the potential noise. We identified the areas on the north side of our energy center fans. We're moving them to the top of our facility and directing them to the southwest, which would point directly into our silos, and they would act as a barrier, our grain silos. In regards to the hammer mills, it's currently on our second or third deck of our between two cement silos. So we have cement silos that are filled with corn on each side, and then we also have cement enclosed on each side. So it's totally surrounded by cement. There is some vents. We have agreed, after consulting with our consultant and MPCA staff, that we would build an additional sound wall inside of the complex where the hammer mills are at, and with acoustical sound barrier paneling to address potential noise issues out of our hammer mill area.
Can I just clarify,
yes,
Mr. Kletcher, is that internal to the building, external to the building?
It's internal to the building, so it would be inside the cement silo, or inside the cement areas. The wall will be inside. So we've got the cement walls, and we've got this barrier, acoustical barrier. And I also have to keep in mind the safety and welfare of my employees when they enter that. So all that's taken into account, and that is... The paneling has been ordered, and it should be installed prior to the end of September.
Thank you.
The fans are currently, should have been started work on that today and moving that up and closing the vents off. In addition, on the north side of our energy center, there's some air intake that just moves air back and forth, helps us regulate. We are putting sound barriers in front of those to deflect the noise. And we believe each of those items will have a significant impact on the potential noise that's being emitted from our facility.
Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Mr. Kushner, I grew up on a farm, and so I'm familiar with a hammer mill, but the ones we use on a farm is a rather small unit. But I recall that it probably cost me half my hearing because when you throw dry grain into that, I mean, and I understand it's a very fast-moving piece of machinery that grinds up the grain as it hits the moving, I don't know what you call them, knives or whatever in there. So it's not actually the noise of the hammer mill, because once it gets going, it's kind of a low hum. But it's actually the grain falling into those knives slamming against the sides of the unit that create the noise. Am I correct?
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Jensen. Yes, the hammer mill, it has the hammers in it. The grain drops down into it. It cracks it up, breaks it up, puts it into a powder, and goes through screens at all at the same time. And then that is transferred over into our process facility. So, yeah, that's where we've identified the hammer mill area as a potential source of noise, and why we're taking the steps, other than the cement around it and the grain inside the silos, to include additional barriers. We do have sound blankets directly around our hammer mills currently, and that was part of our remediation in 2012. But to take it one step further, we still have the blankets in place, and we're also putting this wall in place, if that's truly what the potential noise is.
Thank you. Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Mr. Fleischner, are you just operating one unit now, and you propose to add two, so that would bring it up to three, is that correct?
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Jensen, we currently, under our current permit, operate two hammer mills. And we have, with the new permit application, we would potentially operate up to four. Our intent would be to install and operate three. The reason we look at operating three is to gain efficiencies in regards to production out of our process. We believe with a finer grind in our corn, that we grind it finer, that it will allow us to produce more ethanol out of a bushel of corn. It's about gaining the efficiencies.
Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, Mr. Fleischner, then our question, I guess then my question is, if there's an existing problem now and you're going to add an additional operating unit to it, do you think that the measures you're taking now are going to be adequate to resolve the issues of the noise that apparently a major concern here?
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Jensen, we believe by adding the sound barriers, and our consultants believe by adding the sound barrier wall in that hammer mill area, will address the noise issue that apparently is there. Yeah.
Mr. Clutcher, just your, I mean, there's Mr. Olman provided documentation on your relationship with Mr. Martinson himself. Can you comment at all on your plan moving forward to address those relationships? Because clearly there's not harmony yet, and I would like to hear a little bit more of your company's perspective on your commitment to the to those relationships.
Sure. Commissioner Stein, board members. I pride myself in our company's relationship with our community. I've prided myself in relationships my whole life. My prior history is in grain, corn and soybean farming for the past 30 years. I was actually in dairy for 10 years prior to that. I served as a public servant in Redwood County for 12 years. So I know about relationships. I know that they're important to have. I can probably say we're not going to agree with our neighbors on everything, but I have worked diligently with MPCA staff in the latest noise allegations to address immediately the concerns that have been raised. I don't take this lightly personally, and I don't take this lightly for High Water Ethanol as a company. I represent over 1,500 investor owners. It is my duty to maintain that relationship and make sure our company is viable and stable into the future. And if the test showed that I was out of compliance in regards to noise, it's our responsibility to work with MPCA staff. I believe we've shown that in our cooperation this summer and the remediation items that we've addressed. We immediately planted a row of trees that was requested by our neighbors. Over 1,200 trees were put in. We have plans to plant an additional 400 to 500 evergreen trees. Granted, that doesn't have an immediate impact today, but it's our relationship building on the requests that the neighbors have made through MPCA staff. It was brought up earlier that an offer was made to the neighbor to purchase the property. I absolutely believe that was a right, responsibility if our neighbor believes that it's unbearable, as I've heard, that I should make a good faith effort in communicating with my neighbor that High Water will stand tall and make an offer to buy your property. I know it's not his choice to do that, but I also understand that as a company, if we're bothering that much, then let us stand tall as a company and make that offer, which he respectfully declined, and I respect that. We also made an offer to insulate and side and put new windows in his house. He respectfully declined that, and I respect that decision. So then I look back at High Water, and what are we doing, the items that I believe will correct the allegated noise? I believe we're taking those steps. I will say after we arrived with an agreement with MPCA on the noise, we didn't stop looking at areas in our facility just because we agreed with staff on what our path forward. We've identified around our TO fan, which is a where our thermal oxidizer takes air through and sends it up to our stack. We are doing on our own because we believe it's the right thing to do as a company to add additional barriers around that stack also. It'll be up, I believe it's 15 feet tall. And is that a possibility of noise emissions? It's possible. The consultants we have, it's possible that it's something coming off of there. So we're doing that because we think it's the right move to do. We didn't stop there. We go back onto the other side where our hammer mill area is, and we know we're addressing the hammer mills. But is there other items that potentially could be? With our consultants, we've agreed to, and we've ordered the items, to install a 17 feet high by 37 foot long wall that will basically be in front of bag houses, which have motors on it that operate. So we're taking those steps above and beyond what's proposed in the permit. And we believe strongly that the new permit, and you've heard it from staff, is probably the strictest air and noise permit in the state of Minnesota, requiring us to monitor on a yearly basis. And if we are out of compliance, then I need to go deeper into what we're doing and find out what's going on. We believe what we've proposed and what we're doing will address the concerns of our neighbors. And
thank you, Mr. Kletcher.
Questions?
Mr. Riddle.
Do the other ethanol facilities in the state use a wet milling process? And could you talk about that and your design?
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle. I believe out of the 21 facilities in the state of Minnesota, there is one wet facility, which is located in Marshall, and the rest are dry grind facilities in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Riddle.
If the allegation's correct that yours is much noisier than other comparable facilities, what is the big difference?
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Riddle, if the allegations are correct, it could be the location of the hammer mills. Each facility is designed differently. We're similar to probably four or five other facilities in the state of Minnesota. It's hard to pinpoint. They all have a level of noise that it's emitted, and they're all laid out differently. And their energy center could be a building in front of it, which immediately stops. Noise travels by a straight line. So it could be the layout of the facilities that, you know, potentially causes issues.
Thank you. Dr. Drager.
With all due respect, sir, we heard earlier from MPCA staff that these are not just allegated or a question of if you're out of compliance, but if my understanding and interpretation of what staff said was correct, you are, in fact, out of compliance.
Mr. Kletcher.
Commissioner Stein, Board Member Drager, according to what we signed off on, we are out of compliance.
Thank you. I'd like to bring Mr. Smith back if there are no other questions for Mr. Kletcher and just kind of review what's in the decision, what's in the packet, what's the plan as proposed. Thank you, Mr. Kletcher. So, Mr. Smith, you know, we've heard a little bit about history and a little bit about relationships, a lot about the efforts to mitigate documented violations. Now that's clear. Let me ask you to just summarize the provisions that are committed in the proposal before us today, and just make sure I understand, the board understands what all is included, and then I want to think a little bit more about that.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I think I'd like to mention that it was my pleasure working with Mr. Ullman and Mr. Martinson. They were sincere, and it is my belief that they have suffered with excessive noise for a number of years. It's difficult to quantify. You heard about our Minnesota noise standard and how it's done over time. They've got point meters that measure a point in time, so it's difficult sort of an apples to oranges comparison on the meters and the noise measuring. But it's my belief that there has been instances of excessive noise. We agreed. I agreed with the citizens that we needed to fix this. You also heard from Mr. Ullman the number of complaints that they filed with the agency. Those are also accurate. And frankly, my answer to that is one that's not very satisfactory. It's purely a question of resources within the agency. Ms. Kilgriff is the supervisor of, we've got one air unit at the MPCA. They're responsible for doing regulatory compliance at thousands of air facilities across the state, not to mention the unregulated noise complaints and other complaints from odors to emissions, particulates that are that often come into the agency. So it's my, you know, it's, I regret to say that it's purely a resource question. Should we have been out there sooner? Yes. The company had done noise testing, and that noise testing had shown compliance. Based on that schedule, we try to get out to every facility every 3 years. That is the frequency that we can manage with our current workload. With that said, we absolutely needed to do more with this particular community, with this company, and with these citizens. And we aligned, the PCA staff aligned with the citizens in trying to fix this problem. It's a problem that absolutely needs fixing. I think this is understood, but I'd like to reiterate the fact that issuing the permit and denying the contested case hearing does not in any way put an end to this conversation with the citizens. In fact, it allows us more flexibility and more responsibility and allows us to take action if there are continued violations. This facility must meet Minnesota's noise standards. And this issuing the permit does not change that whatsoever. What it does is it allows us to go in with the beefed up compliance schedules and requirements and take action sooner. So what you see before you, back on the screen, we've got our noise mitigation plan. All the things that must be done in the context of the proposed permit that allows us to take action if compliance is not achieved. Mr. Ullman also mentioned trusting the company and promises made by the company. While promises are just fine, I agree with Mr. Ullman. This is not about trusting the company. We do trust, but we verify, and that is the benefit of the permit before you today. It's not about making promises, providing lip service. It's about taking the requirements that we've negotiated with the citizens and the company, putting them into permit requirements, and then holding the company accountable for complying with those requirements. So, Mr. Commissioner, did I answer your question? Is there another more information you'd like?
I know other board members will have questions, but what I want to understand is if we were to issue a permit amendment and deny the contested case hearing, what would the construction schedule be, and when would the monitoring be available? What would the future look like under that scenario, so that we know there's something on this record that says what that timeline is and what expectations are?
Right now, Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, right now, as I recall, the current schedule and the permit requires that they do noise testing following completion of the new hammer mills and scalper. In other words, they complete construction and then begin a regimen of annual noise testing, which I think we've explained that is more than most facilities do in terms of noise testing around the state in other permits. That noise testing must be done by a submitted. We have to get a plan for how they're going to do the noise testing. It has to be comprehensive, and it has to be the worst case scenario. So they're obligated to make sure that they're not dialing down knobs or doing it at times of day when the plant isn't running. Part of the requirement is that we get a fair and reasonable noise test during the point of the plant operating like it normally would, or even a worst case scenario. Failure to do that is a serious violation of both state and federal regulations. This program, the air program, like the water program as delegated from the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, require self-monitoring by the facilities. And you've heard, and I've heard quite often, that how can you let a facility do their own testing and you can trust that? It is how the federal programs are set up. It is a fair process, and over the years, it has worked very well. Violations of that are a violation of the public trust and result in oftentimes criminal-type penalties and actions. So while it's not ideal, we do not have resources, obviously, to go out and do all the testing required at all the facilities around the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Riddle and then Dr. Drager.
Yeah, two questions. Just following up on that, you know, because of the history here and the situation, wouldn't this rise very high on the list to come back for PCA to check and validate whether the company's testing is accurate? So, I mean, would you have a plan to send the state employees to do the noise testing?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Board Member Riddle, absolutely. We always have the discretion to go back out to a facility and do our own testing at any time of the day. We do a lot of testing on our own through our air program, our water program, our land programs. But obviously, we don't do it. We've got 18,000 facilities, so being out there all the time is difficult. But this one, I would say, specifically to your question, it is now it's in the center of our list of facilities to watch very, very carefully.
So I would hope the petitioners could have confidence that there will be outside ears listening to the noise levels. And then I'm just curious about the final point there, require immediate actions if additional violations are discovered. So say everything's implemented up above, all the noise barriers, but the petitioners continue to have noise and sleepless nights. What would be examples of immediate actions? Would it be fines, plant shutdown, or just letters of warning? I mean, what are these actions?
Smith.
Mr. Chair, Board Member Riddle, yes, the actions that are immediate would be by the company themselves. The permit requires immediate action should they discover areas of noncompliance. So that's, in terms of immediate, that is their responsibility. In terms of our reaction, it may not be immediate, but it must be, our desire is to be very, very quick. This is an escalating enforcement action. In other words, we've got a history of noncompliance, and every time that we come back to this issue with additional areas of noncompliance, we will escalate our enforcement. So that would mean, without saying exactly what would happen, it would be a combination of things such as inspections, daytime inspections. It might be, as you mentioned, doing additional noise testing on our own, daytime and nighttime. It can be and probably would be, if we find, verify violations, that we would be escalating our enforcement response. Additional penalties, moving into negotiated penalties into the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. That is our prerogative. We'll look at those violations appropriately. And then, of course, all that will require immediate corrective action by the company. They must submit to us a plan to make sure that they can meet the noise requirements.
Dr. Drager.
So I heard you say that it is required self-monitoring. Does that mean you cannot stipulate a third-party monitor as well?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Drager, it does not necessarily mean that. The noise monitoring in itself requires sort of specialized service, a specialized skill set. My sense is, and I'll look to my folks, is that most of the noise testing is done by third-party organizations, companies. They will hire a company to come in and do the testing on their behalf.
Heads are nodding in agreement with Mr. Smith.
I just need
Dr. Drager.
Thank you, Commissioner. So, but a third party that reports to this agency rather than to the company. And then my second question is, I mean, it's 2014. We monitor things all over. I look at your air quality indexes all the time. You guys are monitoring stuff and putting it up in real time. Seriously, we don't have technology that we can't put a noise monitor out and get this information?
Smith.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Drager, it is a challenge. Noise monitoring becomes extra challenging in that you can't always tell where the noise is coming from. It is a look at the facility and everything else that's happening in the community. And that's why noise, as you move farther and farther away from the facility, you might have noise violations, but it's very challenging and difficult to determine that it was that particular point source versus truck traffic, other facilities, whatever else, farming activities that are causing and contributing to the noise problem. And you're right, and we do various types of monitoring around the state, but even our air monitoring, this might be a topic for the board for another time, is not comprehensive. And while you see snapshots of how the air is around the state of Minnesota, it is not a point-by-point, neighborhood-by-neighborhood assessment of air. And the noise monitoring is probably even a little more complicated than that. And frankly, we have not done much in terms of the noise monitoring because it has not been a significant issue for the state of Minnesota.
So, Mr. Smith, I want to take you up on your comment that this is in the center of our set of priorities for monitoring and enforcement and compliance verification. I just think that what we are hearing and what strikes me about all this is a less than stellar track record in terms of performance by facility and the agency in terms of addressing this noise situation. I just think that for the benefit of the relationship that I talked about this earlier, that we should do more. We should ask the company to, and perhaps we can do this here today. We can address the problem, compel the company to do the third party monitoring and review those results here is in some more immediate fashion than just sort of a wish that it will happen and that it'll be something that we can all leave here today agreeing on. So I'd ask you for your thoughts on that, maybe a recommendation how we might get that done.
Mr. Commissioner, members of the board, I think that's an excellent idea. My sense is, from the company, is a commitment to follow through both in terms of building and improving relationships out there and a desire to be in compliance with the permit. I might suggest that you invite them back at some point that you think would be appropriate. I know that the construction of the new two hammer mills is happening probably over the winter, maybe the spring. It might be appropriate to have them back next summer or a year from now, and we can, by then we'll have a round of air monitoring, or I'm sorry, noise monitoring done by the facility. We can report on that. We can also have them report on how the relationship with the neighbors are going, if that's improving. And we should have a point where we can do an inspection between now and then on our own to confirm that things are moving in the right direction and we're meeting the noise standard as required, along with all the other air and water requirements of the permit.
All right. Mr. Ibarra.
I have a question or two in regards to the mitigation plan. Mr. Kletcher indicated that the relocation of the ventilation fans was going to begin today and that the dampening partitions have been ordered. I don't recall that he gave a specific date when they anticipate arrival or installation, if they've got a schedule as far as when they anticipate having that completed. And then I would say I'm hopeful that it's safe for me to assume that as they construct the new hammer mills that they don't fire them up until they've got the noise mitigation panels in place. I certainly think that this is a scenario that's gone on far too long. And anything they can do to make sure that all measures are taken to ensure that we don't continue to have violations, I think is not asking too much. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner Smith, the question I had was the location of the monitoring. I know that, you know, it's going to vary if it's monitored right next to the hammer mill operation opposed to at the premises of the petitioner. So where do you monitor? I mean, what's the acceptable level at what location?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Board Member Jensen, I'm going to spin around again. My belief is that they will be doing fence line monitoring around the facility. So that's the point of compliance for the noise standard. Obviously, we did our testing a little bit farther away near a receptor, a person, a family. But their compliance point must be at the fence line. So they'll be setting up their monitoring to do an appropriate 360-degree view around the facility. I'm going to spin around and see if that's an accurate statement.
Yeah, it'd be at the far east end of our property.
Okay.
Right across from our
neighbors. So is there a receptor issue on other sides of the property that need monitoring, Mr. Smith, or would that be? I mean, I'm interested in making sure we don't face the same questions again, that we monitored the wrong thing.
Mr. Chair, we monitored at the closest receptor. I am not sure how far the other neighbors are. There are neighbors. We picked the one that was closest to the facility, so at the greatest risk.
So,
Mr.
Jensen.
That's the issue I have, because noise is going to go at different rates in different directions according to what it has to pass through. So I guess my suggestion, you do more than just one monitoring station, that you'd have to have a couple, because what may be good in a quarter mile down the road one direction won't be in another direction.
Smith.
Mr. Chair, Board Member Jensen, that's a good suggestion. We will make sure that when we receive their monitoring plan prior to the monitoring, that it includes a more comprehensive look around the facility.
Thank you. Dr. Drager.
So I don't want to mischaracterize the decision you make by just kind of trying to summarize. What we're being asked to do is to turn down the contested case hearing from that's being put forward by Ullman and Martinson, approve a permit to do some sound mitigation, but also while doubling the number of hammer mills that are in the facility. But they have, my understanding is that they are out of compliance and they with the hammer mills that they do have. But today we would be approving the addition of more hammer mills. Is that correct?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Drager, they are in compliance. As of today, they are in compliance. We cannot issue a permit to a facility out of compliance. Because of their corrective action, because they paid the penalty and have resolved that past compliance, and because they've got a permit, they've agreed to a permit that includes the items that we've discussed today, they are in effect in compliance today. So that, therefore, the permit would allow us to issue the permit given all the other factors.
And I know, Mr. Ullman, you're desperate to tell us something again, but I have to say that I understand your point of view, and I I need to make sure that I hear from our staff attorney on this question again about what is the nature of the question before the board, because while I respect the citizen concerns, I need to make sure the board doesn't get off track in its decision. So, Ms. Cohen or Mr. Smith, either way.
Mr. Chair, I was going to make one more comment to Dr. Drager's thought. The permit right now contains a compliance schedule, and while there still might be noise going on at the facility, the compliance schedule allows the company a reasonable amount of time to construct and make the changes to the facility that will bring them back into compliance. So that might be the distinction that needs sort of some conversation. There might be ongoing noise violations, but part of our job as regulators, negotiators of permits, is to put in place conditions in a permit through a compliance schedule that bring the facility back into compliance. Obviously, some of these things will take longer than others, and the company has been working hard to make those operational and facility changes. But it's my sense from listening to Mr. Kletcher and having conversations that we're probably no more than a month and a half away from them making these changes. So while noise might be happening right now, the schedule in the current permit is what guides the decision to say that we can issue the permit because it's a reasonable chance that they'll be in compliance a month from now.
Ms. Cohen, if you could address the question before the board today for me, please, and just remind us of our of the legal boundaries that were of that question.
Commissioner, board members, you have two questions before you. One is whether to grant or deny the contested case, and if you deny the contested case hearing, then the question is, do you want to grant or deny the permit? I've obviously trained Mr. Smith very well, or somebody has, because I was going to make the same point that he did, that the company is agreeing to a schedule of compliance in the permit. And the rules of this agency provide that you can grant a permit if the permittee has agreed to a schedule of compliance to resolve any ongoing noncompliance at the time of permit issuance. So you can grant this permit knowing there may be some ongoing noncompliance because you feel, based on what you've heard today, that there is enough in this schedule of actions here that you feel that it is likely that the noise issues will be resolved. And I think what your staff have been trying to say is, and if this isn't good enough, they think it is, they think there's a good basis here, but if it isn't good enough, they are committed and the company is committed to doing whatever is needed to bring the facility into compliance because the staff understands and the company understands that the bottom line is the facility must be in compliance with the existing noise standard. They must comply. So some form of action will be taken above and beyond what you see today if, based on the various inspections and documentations and ongoing monitoring that the permit commits the company to, or the staff's independent monitoring, shows that there is a continuing violation. So, you know, today the question is, we don't seem to have, in the opinion of staff, a dispute with the petitioners regarding the past. We agree with them there was noncompliance. The staff position today is that that noncompliance has been addressed with permit conditions and the understanding that the noise standard will be enforced in the future. As a result, the staff do not feel that there is a reason to have a contested case hearing at this time. You know, the contested case is not about the past. The contested case is about the future. It is about this permit and the ongoing compliance of the company. So whatever happened in the past that was of concern, that would not be an appropriate subject for a contested case. Instead, the contested case should be forward-looking, and it should address a dispute, if there was one, concerning whether or not there's enough here in this schedule to address the ongoing noncompliance. According to Mr. Smith, the petitioners have not come forward with any further suggested corrective actions, So at this point in time, I'm not sure what the contested case hearing would address. We have staff recommendation that these conditions are enough. They think it's good enough, unless there's some information that's brought forward at this time that says, no, no, we have additional things that we want, or we think we have an additional additional information for you, then there could be a contested case, but I haven't heard that today.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. And if I could just what I thought I heard Mr. Smith say earlier in his comments, that the permit allows for additional mitigation efforts above and beyond the simple resolution of violations, that there are additional mitigation measures included in the permit that the company will be accountable for conducting to mitigate noise. While they are modifying their plant and so doing, they are also addressing existing noise concerns as well as future noise concerns by the proposed permit. Is that, am I stating that correctly from your perspective, Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, yes. This is a much more, it's a rigorous permit. It has much more record keeping and monitoring than the previous permits, and it allows the agency to enforce on those actions much more efficiently.
And Mr. Commissioner, if I might add, there was a question about who would be conducting the testing, and I'd like to note that the language in the permit requires that testing shall be conducted by a certified non-vested third party. So that is the language that the agency has proposed for this permit that will ensure that essentially the testing is done by a reliable, non-interested party.
Thank you. Mr. Riddle.
Yeah, just a comment that if we vote to deny the contested case hearing request, I want Mr. Ullman and the other petitioners to know that the MPCA's door is open and the citizen board would like to hear if the company does not come into full compliance.
Thank you. I, too, I want to make sure that we capture the desire to have the company return to the board for future reporting on the performance of the facility. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I want to go back to Mr. Yabarro's statement and question. I think there's listening to the conversation today and listening to many conversations with the petitioners. Right now, the compliance schedule and the permit requires that they do the first test following the upgrade initiation of operation of the new machinery. I might suggest some additional language, and that language, a compliance schedule amendment that we could make immediately, that would say that they would do a noise test, prior to turning on the two new hammer mills and the scalper. This would get to the point of Board Member Yabarro's thought about making sure that the existing facility is in compliance before they're allowed to do something else, turn on the brand new pieces of machinery. I think that that goes to the point of the petitioners as well as the board, if that's agreeable to board members.
Sounds, Ms. Dr. Drieger.
And what recourse is there if they are not?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Board Member Drieger, the recourse is if they've shown noncompliance with that noise test, they're subject to enforcement action from us. That's at our discretion. But they are absolutely will not be allowed to turn anything on. They must retest and retest until they show compliance. So we will escalate as is appropriate for the noncompliant situation, but they will be required to submit a corrective action plan and make changes to the facility, either operational or facility changes that bring the facility back into compliance.
So, Mr. Smith, just for the sake of permit language, it would infer or schedule compliance language until compliance is achieved.
Until compliance is achieved, yes, Mr. Chair.
Seeing no further questions, board members, we have suggested staff resolution on page 8 of the packet. We have further clarified the direction of staff, and I just would I'll try to write something on my own here that clarifies our understanding. So just the from a suggestion to adjust the proposed staff resolution, resolve that we adopting the findings of fact, conclusion of law, and order in support of its approval of the issuance of the permit, that second be it resolved clause will include a statement that two additional statements, and I'll leave this to if the board will indulge us the opportunity to clarify this before I sign off on the findings of fact, conclusion of law and order on behalf of the agency. First, that the schedule of compliance be amended to include a noise test before the new equipment is fully operational, and that noise test demonstrate compliance with the noise standards of the statute, and that no new equipment will be operated until compliance is achieved. A second adjustment to the resolution is that we will adjust the monitoring accordingly so that on-site monitoring is appropriate for all any receptors at the off property, and that the schedule, the monitoring schedule and plan address that. Third item is that the staff and high water ethanol return to the board at some point following construction and demonstration of compliance to report on their operation. So I would offer that as adjustment to the suggested staff resolution based on the conversation we had here today. And if you're agreeable to that resolution, board members, I'd ask for someone to offer it.
I would make that motion, Commissioner.
Thank you. Mr. Jensen moves. Is there a second?
I second.
Second by Mr. Ibarra. Further discussion on the motion? Any further discussion on the motion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote on the matter. Once I find that page. Mr. Ibarra?
Aye.
Dr. Sampson is absent. Dr. Drager?
No.
Dr. Foley?
Aye.
Ms. Hang is absent. Mr. Jensen?
Aye.
Mr. Riddle?
Aye.
And the chair votes aye. The motion is passed. I'd like to thank you I'm sorry, I've forgotten your name now. Mr. Ullman, thank you for coming in today, for making the trip, for staying with us all day, and to the company. I look forward to hearing from you in the future about better days. Board members, I think we have the staff team back in the room for the Riverview Dairy, and would ask them to come forward and present before the board. Yeah. Who would like to take the lead in terms of presenting the document? Mr. Affelt, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, findings of fact that we've put together for a decision, the vote that you took earlier, I'll just quickly review it so that get a quick view of what the content is. The project description is unchanged there. We did simplify the procedural history to indicate when the permit application was submitted and when the environmental review, what some of the key timeline or dates for the environmental review were. And then also when the public notice for the general permit for the feedlot general permit was put on notice. We have indicated that we're using the same criteria that we pointed to in our presentation in subpart 7 of, or 1700 subpart. That doesn't read quite correctly. We'll have to make that change. It's Minnesota Rule 4410, 1700, subpart 7. And we've listed the issues where you have identified where you felt that there was insufficient information to sort support a decision for a negative declaration, and because of that, you've ordered an EIS for this project. The first item is relates to groundwater appropriation, citing there the lack of information, monitoring data in particular, also whether or not situation has changed based on climatic conditions, and also whether there's additional projects that have occurred in that area of the well, such as irrigation wells. The next item is relates to surface water quality and impaired waters. Again, the specific thing that was highlighted there was uncertainty that you have about, or that was provided in the record as to the amount of acreage for land application of manure. And in addition to what the project proposer has under their control. The next item is for the water pipeline. We've cited the questions raised about the mitigation that would be in place for that along the pipeline route, and highlighting impacts on wetland or agricultural lands. With respect to human health, the next item, you've singled out hydrogen sulfide emissions as an area of particular concern where more information is needed. Also, we've, based on the discussion that you've had and the information thus far, we've cited traffic impacts. There are concerns raised in particular about dust generated by traffic. And then finally, at the bottom of page 2, with a conclusion that based on this information is needed for your decision about potential significant environmental effects, and that information is lacking and it can be reasonably obtained through preparation of an EIS. And the remainder of the document simply is provides your conclusions and ends with the order for an EIS.
Questions from board members, comments? Mr. Riddle.
Yeah. I would still like to see some reference to the fact that there already are identified impaired waters in the watershed of the project or proposed project, and that would be added to number 9, right?
Yes.
Right. Just a recognition of that established fact.
Number 9 does read, with respect to surface water quality and impaired waters in the project area.
Okay. It's all happening too fast here. Yeah.
I understand.
Oh, right. It's there. Yep, thank you.
I do see that now. And then the other was, just kind of the cumulative nature of the proposed project, of their own, of Riverview's own facilities, and then all the other CAFOs in that county, the surrounding area. I mean, it's implied in some of the, you know, the groundwater availability, environmental impacts, but we don't talk about cumulative impact. I mean, that word is not used here. That I, of course, it could be, and I just don't see it. But but I, you know, that was a theme as well that I heard.
A couple of points, and perhaps staff could comment on this too. When I look at the statement in number 8, it talks about, you know, sort of the fact that things have changed relative to groundwater, and that there's potential for additional impact analysis. I also think in number 11 regarding potential significant effects related to human health resulting from hydrogen sulfide emissions, perhaps that's another one where and staff might, I just would look to the staff to give us some guidance here on would we benefit from the a finding on the potential for cumulative for these impacts enumerated to result in possible cumulative effects, that because I know that you're we're cautious about concluding that there's a likelihood of cumulative effects before we have the data, and I'm just curious if there's another finding that Mr. Riddle is thinking of that might sort of interweave all of these into the potential for cumulative effects.
Mr. Chairman, how about if we directed staff to do a health risk assessment in the area, which would allow us then to look at all of those cumulative kind of impacts by having a general health risk assessment prepared?
It's a thought, too. Mr. Affelt?
Mr. Chair, board members, I would have these suggestions at this point. I understand that with respect to finding number 8, you're right, the reference to past, present, and future projects is a direct reference to cumulative effects. So I think after the words past, present, and future projects in the area and cumulative effects of the proposed, and the potential for cumulative effects of the proposed water source in the area of the proposed water source.
But that's, that point is only in relation to groundwater availability. I mean, that's the theme of that paragraph. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking about bigger cumulative effects.
Commissioner Jensen. That's correct. I have a couple of other suggestions that would cover a couple of other areas in particular.
Before you proceed, Mr. Affel, I want to hear from Mr. Jensen.
Well, I think he's on the right track. I'll let the staff go.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, okay. Wouldn't it be more appropriate to be known future projects? I mean, you can't just say future projects. I mean, there's no closure there. So if there was already proposed future projects, then you can include that as part of at least what might be affecting the area as opposed to just future projects.
Got that. In number 8, you're talking about proposed future projects in the next to last line. Thank you. Mr. Affel, continue.
Well, and with regard to Dr. Foley's point, we would go, what our intent would be, and it's a little early to speculate on what the content of a scope of an EIS might be at this point, but I think there's probably additional inquiry that can be made along those lines as far as what other projects might be proposed in the area, including other water appropriation permits. Mm-hmm. In number 9, I would add at the end of that paragraph that relates to water quality and impaired waters. So the sentence would read, for manure application beyond that controlled by the project proposer and the contribution of the project to cumulative effects.
Yep.
And number 11, with respect to human health, again, at the end of this sentence, after hydrogen sulfide emissions, I would add from the proposed project and other past, present, or future projects that may be identified.
Yep. Same language as the end of
future.
Number eight.
Known,
yep. known or proposed, something like that. So the same language we have at the end of the finding number eight. So that, just to be clear for the board, what that does, I've got some adjustments to the language just so we're all clear. First of all, of the ones we just recently spoke of, an amendment to the end of the statement on finding eight to talk about proposed future projects and cumulative effects. On number nine, the contribution of the project and to cumulative effects related to water quality. Number 11, again, adding to the end of that statement about cumulative effects from past, present, proposed future projects. I had one additional adjustment that Mr. Affolt mentioned, which was in finding number 7, which was the correction of the rule.
It should read 4410.1700.
Subpart 7, is that correct?
Yep, correct.
Thank you. Dr. Drager.
Then another point that I believe Mr. Riddle raised was, and the staff kind of reflected this on pages 3 and 7 of their response to comments on the EAW, was that comments on socioeconomic issues, if an EIS is ordered, these issues could be included. So there were a number of socioeconomic issues as well. Is that just a given?
That's required.
That is, so that's just a given.
Yep, okay. That would be, Mr. Affle, you might want to comment on that, how the scoping process addresses those.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Drager, yes, socioeconomic impacts along with project alternatives are the two things that are added to basically have to be considered when a scope is adopted, but they are not included in this document because they would not be a basis for making a positive declaration.
Thank you.
Ms. Olson, you had a comment on framing of the conclusions.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Board members, I have a concern on the conclusions because I think it's inconsistent with the findings of fact. Under finding of fact 13, you're saying, pursuant to Minnesota Rule 4410.1700, subpart 2A, you find that the information necessary to a reasoned decision about the potential for significant environmental effects is lacking, but can be reasonably obtained through the preparation of an EIS, which is consistent with subpart 2A. But then if you go into your conclusions of law, you indicate the MPC has jurisdiction to determine the need for an IRS for this project. The EAW, the permit development process, and evidence in the record are adequate to support a reasoned decision. Subpart 2A actually indicates that there is information lacking. So it should be inadequate.
Whoa.
And then I question whether you can make then, based on the record the MPC has determined that significant environmental effects exist, versus your determination would be that you can determine through the EIS that the information necessary.
We'll want to correct that reference in conclusion 14 to be consistent with subpart 2A. Okay. 4410.1700. Is that correct, Ms. Olson?
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll want to actually repeat that language, which is that an EIS will be able to provide that additional information.
Right, so you could actually take out 15 and replace it with 13. Or you could just replace 13, repeat 13 and 14.
Let's repeat 13.
So 14 would be a repeat of 13. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
You'd still want to delete 14.
Oh, there you go. Dr. Foley's a better editor. He's showing himself as a true closet grammarian here. So we'll actually move conclusions of law to begin after number 12.
Correct.
And no. Then eliminate 14 altogether.
And 15.
And renumber those following.
And also eliminate 15.
Yes.
Yes.
And then I actually think you should also indicate somewhere either in the findings of fact that you want the EIS, because you're supposed to actually say that the EIS will include the information and include within the scope of the EIS appropriate studies to obtain the lacking information. So somewhere in here you have to say that the EIS should include any appropriate studies that will obtain the information that the board has determined is lacking. And you could just make that statement.
Can you say that one more time for my advantage?
Why don't we just use the language of subpart 2A under the conclusions of law, and the board, based on the record, the board is making a positive declaration in directing that the scope of the EIS include appropriate studies to obtain the lacking information.
Got it. Any further clarifications from board members? Mr. Jensen.
Commissioner, just for clarification, we now have 16 items. Is that correct?
But for Ms. Olson's last statement.
Yeah, we deleted two and added one, so that, I believe, gets us to 17. Yeah.
I would agree that there's 17.
There are 17.
Okay. So, just to be clear, we've adjusted language. We've moved the conclusion to begin prior to 13. We've eliminated the existing 14 and 15. We have added this statement that the board is making a positive declaration on the need for an EIS and directing the scope of that EIS to obtain the lacking information from these findings.
Yeah, and the above referenced items.
Yep.
As well as to include the two required items of alternative analysis and social economic factors.
Yep. That would be required as part of preparing an EIS. Further discussion from board members or questions? Ms. Olson, can I ask you about the clarification now? With this direction of staff, we can take action on this motion and have the staff then prepare the final documents for my signature with concurrence of the board. Is that correct?
That is correct. You would want to include in your motion to direct you to do that.
Who would like to verbalize that motion?
I'll gladly say so moved. But to actually repeat it, I don't know that I'm up to it. But
that might work. If we can just pause for a few seconds while Ms. Olson proposes an amendment to the current recommendation, I'll then read it into the record and someone can so move it.
Sounds like a plan. Uh-huh.
So the recommendation now reads as follows, and then I'll read the suggested staff resolution. The MPCA staff recommends that, in accordance with the standards and criteria set forth in Minnesota Rules 4410.1700, the board, (1) approve the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, which conclude that the proposed project does have the potential for significant environmental effects, (2) authorize the commissioner to publish a positive declaration indicating that the proposed project will require an EIS, and (3) adopt the following staff resolution. Staff resolution says, be it resolved that, in accordance with the standards and criteria set forth in Minnesota Rules 4410.1700, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency approves and adopts the attached findings of fact, conclusions of law and order, which include that the Riverview LLP/Baker Dairy project proposed by Riverview LLP and analyzed in the environmental assessment worksheet, does have the potential for significant environmental effects, The commissioner is authorized to execute the findings in fact, conclusions of law and order on behalf of the MPCA. Be it further resolved that the MPCA authorizes the commissioner on behalf of the MPCA to publish a positive declaration on the need for an environmental impact statement, Now, Mr. Riddle.
So moved. I know there was a reason I couldn't do that.
And I will second that.
Mr. Jensen makes seconds the motion. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we will make sure I have the right page in front of me again and call the question. Mr. Ibarra?
Aye.
Dr. Sampson is absent. Dr. Drager?
Aye.
Dr. Foley?
Aye.
Ms. Hang is absent. Mr. Jensen?
Aye.
Mr. Riddle?
Aye.
The chair votes aye. Motion passes. Thank you to the staff, to all the participants in the meeting today. Board members, thank you for your attention and diligence during the meeting today. We greatly appreciate your service. We're completed. And Dr. Foley moves adjournment. We are adjourned.